Hi, I'm Jo Beth.
I'm Nate.
And I'm Katrina. And this is Home Team. In this episode, we discuss the book Policing the Crisis, Mugging the State and Law and Order by Stuart Hall, Chaz Kircher, Tony Jefferson, John Clark, and Brian Roberts, and play a microgame entitled Policing the Podcast. Welcome back to Home Team, everyone. We are going to do things a little bit differently on this podcast. So Nate is going to introduce our micro game at the start here, which bodes well for us.
Yeah, so here's how it's going to work. This game is called Policing the Podcast. I think we can all agree that the one thing wrong with this podcast is that there hasn't been enough enforcement of laws and order. And so we are going to play a little game where while we record, we're going to introduce some new laws.
Oh, God.
So you two are going to both be deputized to enforce these laws. If you catch each other breaking the law, you get a point. Now, you do each have a quota of 20 points.
Oh, my God.
After that, you'll be in overtime where you'll get 2 points each. We're just going to start with the first law for an example. Anytime you say Britain, Great Britain, the UK and England, the next sentence must be followed in a British accent.
Oh my.
I believe on a previous episode, we used a little bit of our British accent talent and our British listeners were offended and sort of brought this up as an issue we needed to address legally. So we're choosing to legally address it by enforcement of more British accents. So you'll notice that on your soundboard up top, you have some new buttons. So the royalty-free sound that we're going to use for citing the other player, you've been deputized. So to get the point, you have to cite the other player with this royalty-free sound.
Oh, fuck.
Which is a British man saying, oh, fuck.
Okay.
Okay,
this is going to get wild.
Are there more laws?
That's law number one.
Oh, God.
So this is a law stacking game?
Yeah, this is a law stacking game.
Oh, no. I think we've given Nate Too much free reign.
too much power.
The struggle
going
with that
to their
is
head.
I am the chief of police in this fictional scenario. So good luck reining me in.
But hey, if we're trying to be abolitionists, should I not call out Katrina when she doesn't do the thing?
Since in this scenario, Katrina is also a police officer, I believe that would be that would also be just what do they call it? Professional courtesy.
It's internal standards. It's internal affairs.
All right. So do y'all understand?
I think
the rules
so.
Of the game.
Yes, I think so.
Yep.
Awesome.
I know that people really wanted to hear more of my phenomenal British
accent.
That's
really what this is all about.
All right, take it away.
Cool. So a bit of a disclaimer for our listeners. Katrina has read this book in a course before.
But years this ago. Time,
years ago. This time around, did not get an opportunity to make their way through the whole thing. I did not finish this book. I read through chapter 7, and through chapter 7 is a generous description of how I interacted with chapter 7. But I think we'll be able to give you a general kind of what the main core points of the book are. And then hopefully if you're a big hall head and want to come to the reading group and school us on what we missed, please do. So this book is generally about this moral panic that happened around mugging, and specifically the definition of mugging being sort of the idea that some random person is walking down the street at night and they get accosted by a person or a group of people and are potentially assaulted and robbed. And it sounds like in the place that this this occurred in jolly old England. This is well-known phenomenon that happened in the 1970s. Period. That's the end of my sentence. But that what the book sort of unpacks is sort of what a moral panic is, why this in this particular instance was a moral panic, and just dives into a lot of social and even like economic theory about all the different factors that lead people to have reactions to particular types of crimes. So we'll dig more into that later, but that's kind of a general overview of what this book is about.
Yeah. There are a ton of authors on here, and I'm just going to do a quick introduction to Stuart Hall because it would take forever to talk about all of them, but they're all kind of connected through the Birmingham School of Cultural Studies, period. Which was invented largely and co-founded by Stuart Hall himself, period.
I'm sensing a lot of sentence fragments in this podcast. I'm just going
to
say
that we've already hit on that there are loopholes to the law. We will find a way.
You can get away with anything. Yeah. Stuart Hall is like one of the people primarily credited with inventing the field of cultural studies. And it's this approach that kind of extends a lot of other fields, including people studying economics, people studying politics, people studying criminology. And cultural studies kind of extends all of these fields through a Marxist lens that is expanded to also talk about race and gender. Two fun facts, if you are a bell hooks head, as you should be, they had a conversation, Stuart Hall and bell hooks had a conversation, and it's now, it got like written up into a book. The Metro Library has the audiobook of it, highly recommend. I think it's called Uncut Funk, really good. And Tolkien was one of Stuart Hall's professors in college. So
that's interesting.
That's your fun fact about Stuart Hall. He is like one of the most important theorists for my work, and people doing the kinds of things that I do and people doing other things too, because he's brilliant and has written extensively about a lot of things. So you could read just Stuart Hall forever and never get bored.
Well, before we move on to our next poignant point, I think this is a good time to introduce our second law.
No!
I think y'all are too fixated on avoiding the one law, which is, you know, it's easy when there's one law.
Well, it's easy when we haven't gotten into the specifics yet, but I feel like we're going to have to mention it.
So for law number two, we're going to go ahead and address head on that there is a crisis at hand here. Maybe a manufactured crisis, but there is a crisis. So anytime you use the word crisis or the word urgent or the word emergency, you must say whoop whoop immediately afterwards. And you can play the royalty-free siren sound to cite the other players if they fail to make a whoop whoop after. Again, that's crisis, urgent, or emergency. Let's really quickly hear that royalty-free siren sound.
Okay.
Crisis, whoop, whoop. Perfect.
Back to the poignant.
Okay. So the first chapter is really like Hall et al. Detailing the specifics of kind of like for people who aren't familiar essentially with this moral panic that happened in the like late 60s, 70s in the UK, period, semicolon. He sort of like out. Are you getting me on that one? Okay. I'll give it to you.
You said period first.
Oh, dang it. Okay. I'll try to do better. But yeah, so kind of like, talks through like kind of some of the like news stories that informed like kind of the rise of this conversation. And then even talks about, and this is what I thought was really interesting, talks about like the connections to like that mugging is kind of an American term that got adopted as this developed. And so there's like a lot of social implications for that, particularly in the late 1960s. And then the next two chapters sort of end up focusing on the response to that through particularly like state mechanisms of like policing and the judicial system, like the legal system, and then also the news media apparatuses, and how they are also sort of implicated or contribute to these narratives and sort of end up replicating this idea of what might be happening when the actual like facts on the ground might not actually be matching up with the sense that it's like happening everywhere all the time and we all need to be on guard and we need the police to be out 24/7 at these places. And then, and something I thought about specifically in just, yeah, like the, that first kind of section, if you will, is like the idea that like ramping up the response to it because of some, like a few incidents that got a lot of attention, like then sort of resulted in more suspected occurrences, like more arrests, because police were like in the subway station, they ended up arresting young Black men that they were thought they might start mugging someone. There's a lot of questions about whether that's the case. And so then that like replicates the sense that this is a real huge deal and is a crisis, whoop whoop, that the state needs to have some kind of formal response to. So yeah, that's kind of like, to me, that felt like the first section of kind of like, what was happening and kind of what was the like, sort of these different parts of a culture's response, that kind of ended up creating this sense of a moral panic, out of a few, like, I mean, there were like, he does detail some very horrific incidents of violence, but even talks about like, even those were really outliers in sort of what people were thinking about and the idea that like, there's a difference between like mugging and just like pickpocketing and sort of all the racial and class implications with that, sort of felt like the first section, and then sort of moves on to talking about a specific pretty horrific incident of and kind of what the legal response was. These young men who were charged with like beating this man, I believe, kind of again, like a kind of a late night situation, going home late at night, these young men like beat up and steal this person's stuff and then like come back and maybe beat him up more. And got like a really, really, because of kind of where this happened in sort of the panic. I'm going to just go whoop whoop that because it feels appropriate. Panic whoop whoop. They got really like sort of made examples of by the judicial system and by the legal system and getting really long sentences. And sort of, so that then after that, kind of that next section really is like, what were the public responses to it through like letters to the editor and how people kind of explained and responded to sort of the, what are the like liberal responses to crime and that like young people don't have things to do or the people are in economic straits. And so they resort to stealing kind of compared to the harsh, more like, I think Hall refers to it as kind of the traditionalist view of like lock them up, put away the key kind of thing, or yeah, throw away the key. And that's where it feels like he starts to get into talking a lot about class and kind of the class implications and relationships. And that is started to be where I started to struggle and have to just let the words wash over me, because that gets really, it feels like it can get very theoretical very quickly.
Yeah. Totally. Sometimes you just gotta let it wash over you and you get what you get, and that's okay. Part three is kind of generally about the state's role in dealing with crime, quote unquote, and how the state can and does use emergency whoop whoop conditions to build out consent for, in this instance, more authoritarian policies. And then the last part is just one very long chapter that kind of looks specifically at the politics surrounding mugging as a moral panic, which is not on our whoop whoop list, but we can whoop whoop it if we want to. One of the things, yeah, so that's like, that's the book basically. And we'll get into some more depth. One of the things that you mentioned that I wanted to say more about is that the language of mugging was brought over from the US. And I think that's really important because that is like bringing over a highly racialized context in a way that the UK likes to ignore. Oi, matey. Loophole.
Oh my God, just say it with me. That's a sentence.
It's a sentence. It's a full sentence. There's an exclamation point.
Punctuation.
Yeah. And so this was also happening during a moment where people in the UK were very focused on the shifting realities of the racial makeup of the UK in the same way that is still happening today with Brexit and all that other nonsense. Period. I was going to continue my sentence, but I didn't, and now I'm talking, so that's, you've got it. This is making it really hard to like keep my train of thought. Anyway,
I think what we're learning is both of us speak in a lot of run-on sentences. Yeah, we use a lot of semicolons instead of periods.
For sure.
So I'm not sure where my sentence ends and where I need to start speaking.
Right. Like we, yeah. Anyway, racism is at the heart of all of this. There's classism and racism.
Yeah, And I think like to that point, something that I really thought was really interesting, and it's, I think too, like, placing this book within the sort of curriculum, if you will, of like all the other books we've been reading, is specifically that relationship to like the West Indies, and that that is where a lot of Britain's immigration is coming from at that time. So, oi, matey. No, okay. I was like, yeah, I can't think of like where I was going with that weird sentence. But I did loopholes. But yeah, that like, that idea of sort of what is like Britishness and that those people don't count. Yeah, I feel like I didn't really capture the spirit of the law. So,
it's also come to my attention that there's been a request for a new law. Well, really just updating the current law on the books to include enforcement of the word panic as well. So we're going to go ahead and adopt that into the criminal code.
So just spring a new... Just, yeah, amending ordinances left and right here.
Also, JoBeth, if I'm writing these down.
I did, yeah. I've written down code words to remind me.
Let's talk about how the moral panic whoop-whoop is related to people's beliefs about crime. Because I think that's an important piece of this.
Yeah, what are people's beliefs about crime? Essentially that it's everywhere all the time and they have to constantly be on the lookout and it could happen to them at any moment.
One of the things that is in the first chapter, I think, is a whole little few paragraphs about how white people believe themselves to be like even just possibly the victims of a crime, mm-hmm. not even that they were like actively being victims of a crime or that they knew someone who were victims of a crime. It was just the like shift in their perception of their racial class group mm-hmm. as like people upon whom crimes could be perpetrated was a thing that like put them in so much fear that they decided to move out of the city.
Yeah. And I think like specifically something that I thought was really interesting in what Hall was sort of detailing, particularly about like the news wasn't even necessarily kind of what the news's role is like they weren't even necessarily reporting on incidents that happened or like the mm-hmm. data. They would report on particular, detail in these charts, like how many instances of mugging or sort of mugging adjacent things were reported in various newspapers and sort of what the height of that was. And often it was like reporting on the same instance that mm-hmm. had happened, mm-hmm. but because you're seeing it in a new way, different time, mm-hmm. you're learning about a different part of the process of that. The sense that it's like happening everywhere all the time. And then mm-hmm. something that I really got out of this book that felt really new to me was really talking about the judiciary's role and specifically talking about their role in potentially like moralizing about mm-hmm. particular crimes and like when they mm-hmm. choose to, like, it's very, you know, judges' words and statements mm-hmm. carry a lot of weight. And so reporting on like the judge made this sentence when during sentencing mm-hmm. And sort of talking about just the way that these sort of like public conversations are happening that then sort of like melt into people's consciousness about what's happening around them that might not really actually be the way that it is. It's just what they're sort of hearing and seeing. And I think we can see that in our day to day now where it like the kind of, if it bleeds, it leads, particularly with like TV media news, like that these sort of sensationalized moments of like, whether it's violence or theft or property damage or whatever, make like, there's this sense of like emergency to it because it feels so present and all the time. What did I do? Oh, did I say emergency? Dang it. Ah, he kind of goes into like, you know, that actually crime statistics are very difficult to actually mm-hmm. rely on because like how many people are, there's so many questions surrounding statistics of reported crimes. And so that's like a whole other book probably to write. But the idea that like, we sort of have this sense of like, this is the way that things are happening because whether intentionally or not, there's these various social institutions that are kind of in conversation that are then affecting the way that day-to-day people, you know, the people not in those positions of power or like culture shaping, ingest or sort of process what's happening in the world around them. Like you said, whether or not they ever witness, interact with, know of someone who is affected by this, there's just this sense that it's, and I think like, you know, I'm going to shout out the You're Wrong About, because like the kind of my entrance into like really defining what moral panics are, and like it really is wild to like read sort of like this, dang it, whoop whoop panic, whoop whoop, yeah. I was like, what did I say, moral crisis, whoop whoop, but yeah, that like that you can detail like satanic panic, you know, like all of these things, like whoop whoop, dang it, you got me. I saw your face. Yeah, just that like all of these things that she talks about on You're Wrong About, like, are just these like cultural responses mm-hmm. to these incidents. But that when you start to peel away at them, there's mm-hmm. so much more going on. And that doesn't like that, I feel like, again, is like a book of itself. And then he starts to get into mm-hmm. like the like economics and people's class, you know, base needs, but they're not like identifying with their class because they're identifying mm-hmm. with these other like categories of identity. And yeah, it's just like, there's so much to wade through with this book. I feel like
it's, I could, It's 400 pages of very brilliant, very dense thinking. And I don't know. I think that you gain a lot from having a book that's written with a bunch of people. It probably took a lot longer and was a lot harder, but I think it's richer for it. One of the things that you mentioned, the statistics bit of this, that has been like one of the things that has stuck with me and is the coolest and most interesting in terms of making sure that I'm paying attention to this in my research. What they're talking about in this book is that the statistical category of mugging was fully created out of nowhere. And there's no way to actually verify any of the reported numbers because the category basically doesn't exist in a lot of like...
Yeah, it's like there's so many different variations
that
like there's no one, like no one instance of what we would and they would call mugging has every single part. And so like it's just people sort of saying, oh yeah, I think that was mugging.
And it's such a good reminder that the things that we call crimes and the things that are charged as crimes are never static or like a given. They are very mutable in themselves. I don't know. That was good.
I think this is a good good place for us to introduce the idea that as you're talking about crime sort of being defined by us and what we criminalize, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our third law into the game now, which is that anytime you say a word that has the word crime as the root, so crime, criminal, et cetera, you're going to say it like crime, a little bit higher pitched. And a failure to do so, you can cite your fellow players with the royalty-free popular television show sound alike sound.
Criminal. I didn't think about like criminology.
Okay.
We should stop talking about crime and move on to something else to save us, girls.
We'll keep talking about it. One of the things that kind of comes up both in the term, in the context of the moral panic whoop whoop and the later sections of this book, is the idea that the state is sort of furthering and taking advantage of the reaction to mugging to increase what the state can do in specific categories. And this is a concept that comes from the Nazis. Notable Nazi Carl Schmitt is the person who invented the idea of the state of exception, which is where under an emergency condition, the state is able to dramatically increase its power and ability to do like authoritarian things. And so that is a thing that other people have theorized based on, because, you know, Nazi, but that is like a really important part of Nazi ideology that is utilized in a lot of other lesser and non-lesser forms. And I think that this moral panic whoop whoop is one of the ways that that happens.
Well, and it generally sounds like moral panics, whoop whoop, are like that, yeah. Right? Like where it's like you think about like the sort of quintessential of like right before my lifetime as satanic panic, whoop whoop, like that there was like real world consequences and like the whole like, I mean, it's still reverberating today of like stranger danger and like the idea that like, like that narrative that like the people that you should be afraid of are strangers in a white van, but really like most kidnappings are by a person that child knows.
Yeah.
And so it's just, yeah, like, I mean, when you say that, I'm just like, oh, my whole life, America has been in a moral panic about something. And like most of my life, it's probably been a lot Islam, dang it, whoop, whoop, like Islamophobia. Like I just, because when you say that even about like, I think about manufactured consent around like Iraq and 9/11. Mm-hmm. And that like, there's, I just feel like you can, this, it's almost like in this book, they have created a map. Geography, that you could like lay all of these other, you could, like across decades, across geography of across the world of like how people in power utilize like certain narratives to scapegoat certain groups of people. And like, it just like, it is the, like, I think it was interesting reading this book because I was like, this all sounds so old hat. And like, I just, I know all this, but like, this seems like at the time, this is like maybe the first time this is really being pointed out in any like systematized way of like, this is this situation in this particular time, but that you can like extract the framework and sort of put other places and times on it.
That's a perfect segue into conjunctural analysis, of which this is an example. And that, the term conjuncture comes from Gramsci. Other people had used it before. But it's kind of this method of researching and theorizing that looks at material circumstances and the conditions that created the circumstances in like a set period of time. So it's like this moment where this specific set of circumstances with these specific policies and these specific actors, et cetera, make up this set of conditions. And that's probably like not the best definition of this term because I'm still coming to terms with it, if you will. But I think it's important to note that it's not always been the case that people who are researching focus on culture and ideology in the ways that these folks did. And I personally think that that's a really important way to study moments, because if you're just taking economics separately from the news, I think you're doing everybody a disservice.
Yeah.
Because those things are connected.
Do y'all feel like this would be a good time to introduce our final law?
Another one?
I like the word final.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, hold on to that thought.
I know that whole time we didn't say crime.
Yeah, I know. It's wild. I hope it pops up.
I have a prediction for this one.
Go ahead.
Is it going to be we can't say the word like?
That's part of it.
Or.
Okay, oh, no. So let's just jump right in. Law number four. The word like and the phrase the ways in which have now been criminalized. Anytime you hear this word or phrase used, you can play the royalty-free sound of a likable witch. And you can legalize the word like by using it twice in a row.
Oh.
So if you say like, you skate by.
It's my main filter.
You know, I did add in that legalization measure with you in mind, Joe Beth. I also introduced the ways in which, because someone else on this podcast uses that phrase quite a bit. I won't name names.
That could be.
I do better than some people. You can't see Nate's face right now, but I need y'all to know that Nate is having a blast.
Loving it. Loving it.
Anyway, I want to shout out a thing that is going to be linked in the further reading email. The Conjuncture podcast, aptly named for this type of analysis. I linked the one that is specifically talking about Hall, Gramsci, and conjuncture analysis as like a method. I watched a little bit of that podcast and it was quite good. So
cool.
Always more to learn. I do feel like these laws, like, God damn it. I feel as though these laws are prohibitive to our conversing.
The ways we could converse.
Nice.
Although, like, I mean, looking at our list, I feel like we have covered, most of the stuff we wanted to talk about. Was there anything else that you had?
The point of this book is that there was not a rise of mugging. And the study being done in this book is specifically about the reaction to the moral crisis created and manufactured in response to a made up set of circumstances. And I think that that's important to think about in the context of our present moment. We could talk about immigration. We could talk about how every year it seems as though there are TikTok trends of young people committing crimes that are fake and don't actually happen. I was at the gas pump the other day and remembered how 10 years ago people were really afraid of people putting needles on gas pumps to spread HIV. That never happened. That was a thing that people talked about in maybe just rural Indiana. But that never happened. Never did I see an actual report of that. It's just kind of like things.
The razor blades and the candy.
dang it.
Ugh. Yeah. Or putting drugs in candy. Drugs are expensive. No one's putting them in candy.
Right. Yeah.
Speak for yourself. You heard of edibles?
Well, they're not giving them to your children because it's expensive.
Word.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a little bit of what I was kind of the reason to mention you're wrong about or another podcast that's kind of like in the family there is American Hysteria, where Chelsea Weber Smith walks through it's a lot of the urban legend and moral panic, whoop whoop adjacent sort of things, particularly within an American context. like I said earlier, it just feels so interesting that a group of people have kind of mapped out what sort of the sort of ways in which I realized it as the last two words were coming out of my mouth. I looked over at my little pad I have written down here.
You thought that one was safe.
I was like, I never say that. Oh, wait, I probably do say that all the time. But even, you know, and what something I really liked this book is the discussion of sort of like how the liberal view and what they call the traditionalist view are really lacking. Mm-hmm. Like both of them have lacking because they're not focusing on class and to what you were saying earlier, dang it. Class, race, they're not digging past just sort of the oh, people don't have jobs. And I think to your point earlier about thinking about our context today, we're just kind of stuck in the same conversation. And something that I'm hopeful maybe that the Overton window shift from 2020 and sort of using, even though I think this language has maybe kind of run its course or gotten co-opted by state apparatus, the idea of reimagining public safety and trying to use different language than just kind of being stuck in, people just do bad things because they're bad people, versus the like, well, people have come from different difficult places, and so that leads them to crime. Is like, well, that's like, there's, you're just missing so much there.
That was crime. A scary noise. Crime.
Oh, did I say? Oh, I. Dang it, man! I cannot keep up with these. I really do appreciate the way in which you stacked these. Beat getting harder and harder.
Hang on. That was a.
Did I?
Yeah.
Did I? Yeah. this linkage between me and being a witch is not helpful for my public the public perception of me. But yeah, I just like I hope that we've maybe like having a cultural conversation, we've maybe gotten to a little bit of a place where we're kind of peeling that back a little bit more. But in many ways, when I think about the conversations I have around these issues, and talking with people in the city about their perceptions of like how bad their neighborhood is, or what, you know, whatever the perception of how crime is all around them all the time. It feels like we're just kind of, again, having the same conversation. Dang it.
I think that Alec Karakatsanis's work on propaganda is one of the best, like modern examples of an intervention into those kinds of repeated conversations that we're having. I use it to teach my students, and I think it's good. He just came out with a new book that I haven't gotten my hands on yet, but I'm linking to his newsletter, which has a lot of his writing in it, for the reading for the email. Nate, you've exhausted us.
I'm so sorry.
We're so tired.
This is a constant vigilance situation.
The which crimes are all around us.
Which I do think this is a very good object lesson in that people who are constantly subject to surveillance and particularly like criminalization of behaviors, like even if it's just literally just existing in a public space because of all of these various factors, and the fact that the state, the community does not have good solutions to provide to this history and where we are in this moment, it's exhausting. You're on 100 all the time, and that's going to affect how you interact with the world. I'm really glad you didn't make one of those words, because that's
I actually had it in an earlier draft, and I was like, this is too much. I will say, though, I don't want to step on key takeaways, but the last part of this game that I had was for us to reflect on it and talk about how we can like sort of tie it into the real world. So I kind of feel like you've beat us to the punch there a little bit, JoBeth, but I very much appreciate it.
I could.
How about some bonus points for that? We're going to give you like 3 bonus points.
Okay.
For that.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I have a takeaway. I was going to say, this makes me think of the study that was done that shows that even something as minute and quote unquote harmless as a traffic stop, just that interaction with a police officer, even if there's no citation or things that result from the traffic stop, make people less likely to vote in the next election, because it like fractures their trust in the system and makes them feel not like a true participant in our society. What did I say?
Not like a true participant.
Oh,
it's so tough. It's everywhere. So tough.
I can either be thinking about not doing the bad thing, or I can be thinking about what I'm saying.
Which, is also a takeaway.
Yeah. Yep. Good and horrible game, Nate.
Sorry, y'all.
Good and horrible.
Do y'all want to do any key takeaways from the book really quick to sort of wrap things up?
I think a key takeaway for me that is not necessarily a new thing, but is something that is explained in detail in this book in such a way that I have not seen elsewhere done this well, is the idea that fear about crime is often more motivating. Crime is often more motivating than the actual material reality of crime conditions themselves.
Yeah, no, that's something to just, I think, always be thinking about when we're ingesting and consuming what the world has to offer to us. I think for me, a takeaway that we didn't talk about too much, but feels very, we maybe touched on a little bit, sort of the migration of the word mugging. But particularly, and as much as I don't want to talk about the island that is England, because now I have to talk in a British accent for at least a sentence, period. how much that we have in common, like.
Technically, this is the next sentence.
I'm still not sure. I understand exactly how I'm supposed to do that because I do not speak in Chinese sentences.
Yeah. Yep.
But just how much we have in common, like our culture and what is being talked about. And I think that probably a lot of that has to do with race and sort of our racial categories. But I have to assume there's some history of the U.S. also being a colony, that some of the same seeds of culture were being planted here through empire, and then sort of the accumulation or non of wealth, and then slavery and other people migrating, and it feels so interesting how much this could have, I felt like, been written about the U.S. And sort of does, I think, mention at some point that there was a little bit of a panic whoop whoop in the U.S. around mugging, but it was also sort of caught up in the just sort of the 60s, like law and order, you know, all of the chaos of Vietnam and the responses in the U.S. to it and that sort of thing.
I think that the mugging example is especially interesting in the British context because of how narrow the definition is for people to be British. Oi, matey. And I think that the specific, like, spatial distance between... Dang it. Between slavery practice and slavery as a way to accumulate capital, I think that that disconnection is very important to British society. Oi, matey. Anyway.
There's so much more, but also...
We could do again.
It could be forever.
Like all of these books, we could talk forever. But I think we're at a good moment to wrap this up and have Nate give us the damage.
Yeah, tell us what we've won.
You know, I have bad news for y'all. You did all that work, and neither one of you hit quota. So you've both ultimately been dismissed from the force.
Perfect.
That's
the ideal scenario.
Jo Beth with 10 points. Katrina with 15. I will also say that I heard from the DA that since y'all were both in the line of duty while committing these crimes, all of the charges have been dropped and they're not pursuing charges. So y'all kind of lucked out there.
And you know what? The city paid for that. We didn't have to pay a dime.
So really, I would say in some ways we're all the winner here. And in some ways, what a waste of effort.
Losers.
But thank you all for playing. As always, this has been
Home Team.
Oi, matey. Oi, matey. Oi, matey.